Welcome again, dear listeners, to Food Conversations, Season 8. Before we begin, we cannot forget that we live and work in Squepikulu, the ancestral unceded and actually stolen land of the Squepik people. Every day it becomes clearer that doing the best we can to resolve this historical injustice is a critical responsibility for all of us. Now, a journalist once said, "It's the luck of the Irish, or lack thereof, that they must constantly leave their shores." This situation is probably connected to the fact that Ireland was the land where England first cut its colonial teeth, culminating in the horrors of the Great Potato Famine. A decade ago, nearly a quarter of Canadians were of Irish descent, and before that, the Irish have been the largest immigrant community after the English and French. Today, though, the Irish come to Canada for much more positive reasons. And we have in the studio with us today an Irishman who came to Canada to practice environmental law and stayed for love. He has already made his mark on his new home in a number of ways, and we're going to talk about that today. Owen Madden is, in his own words, a recovering lawyer who eventually became a farmer and is now the owner of Nature Delivered, an expanding food delivery service that is helping to return food growing and distribution to its longtime local and regional roots. Owen, we are delighted to have you join us in the studio today.
Lovely to be here. I better qualify that by saying I am only the co-owner of Nature Delivered, and if my wife were to hear that I was classed as the owner of Nature Delivered, I might be in a lot of trouble. So, you know, I am glad to say I co-own a business that's quite the experience right now, and we make a good partnership, me and my wife, Emily.
Now, things have changed a lot in Ireland in recent years, especially in the economic front in particular. Now, you grew up in what's come to be known as the Celtic Tiger period, which shaped experiences in your own life. And I'd like you to share with listeners what that phrase means and what the phenomenon is and how it came about and how it changed things for Ireland.
Yeah, well, I was born in 1980, and the 80s in Ireland were always classified by my mom specifically as a grim time, you know, when you're between ages 1 and 10 and you've got clothes on your back and friends to kick a soccer ball on the street with. I found it great, but certainly times were tough, and there was actually quite a lot of emigration out of Ireland, and I'm sure a lot of the Canadians who get classed as Irish or of Irish descent arrived into the country in that time. In the mid-90s, a confluence of different issues brought wealth to Ireland in a very sudden way, starting with some very, very forward-thinking decisions in the 60s by Irish leaders when there wasn't actually a huge amount of money available to the government. They made third-level education free. And that meant that people were paying very, very high tax rates. Certainly my parents were, who were civil servants, but it led to a very highly educated young workforce. The Catholic Irish also like to have lots of babies, contraception being quite stigmatized until my teenage years. And so there was big families with many kids, all of whom were very well educated, you know, on the balance, you could say. And with these deep and charismatic connections to America, the second thing the Irish government did that's related to this was they formed a group called the IDA. And those guys, what their and ladies, their job was to basically smooge all these very large American corporations.
Sounds like Irish Development Agency or
exactly.
Something like that.
Exactly. Industrial Development Agency, I think that's what it stood for. But off they went to the United States and managed to woo some big companies onto the Irish shores under the auspices that we could speak English. We were highly educated. There was good universities had been sponsored by the government to be there, and it could be a European base, and it really took off. And so from 1995, what became known as the Celtic Tiger brought a pseudo-American, I would say, sense of affluence to Ireland, and terms like SUVs started to become spoken about. And it definitely, I mean, you take a nation that hasn't been used to money and you introduce it to money in a quick fashion. I mean, the Irish economy performed in the top three in the world for almost a decade or more. to the point where economists were studying what had happened there.
There's an anomaly here.
And so, yeah, a very Americanized sense of affluence developed there, and only really came to a halt when, in the 2008, 2009, banking issues broke out in the United States. The financial, I don't think they call it a full collapse, but it was certainly a financial issue.
Big challenge.
Yeah, the banking-related and mortgage-related challenge that came about in the United States. They say when America sneezes, Ireland catches a cold. And so it brought about a very rapid decline in our fortunes at the time. And
it's been up and down.
It was up and down. But I would say, I mean, to summarize what happened in Ireland, it was a great big party, to be quite honest. And it was a lot of fun to be a 15-year-old right through to your early 20s. And I was looking ashore for my future prior to things slowing down. It wasn't an economic slowdown that caused me to leave.
Let's talk about one particular feature that you told me about that you were able to take advantage of and had a big influence on what you did. And that's an unusual feature, and I believe it applies to government jobs, but I could be wrong there, that you could take a career break without losing your job. And it could be up to 4 years. I mean, that doesn't sound very American to me. America would say work 12 hours, 7 days a week instead of six. But this was, what an inspired thing, because it actually gave you an opportunity to hop on your bike and head out across Europe and not worry that you wouldn't have a job if you came back.
Yeah, true. Like I had some challenges trying to find my feet within law and found my way into public service as a way to sort of eventually dip my toes into the issues of environmental protection and climate change. I think what happened there was the government realized that it had a lot of quite well-paid civil servants, and I was one of those, and it decided to offer people like me an opportunity to disappear for up to 4 years, renewable every year, right? So every year you got this letter to say, well, are you coming back? And me and my unsettled nature in my 20s and my lure towards getting on my bike and exploring Europe, it was the perfect opportunity for me, and I took it.
Well done. Well done. I think that's that's called opportunity knocks and you open the door. Well, we'll talk about your trip to Europe in a little bit, but by the time you took off, you'd already been a criminal lawyer for nearly a dozen years in the public service. And this was The phrase you use, you stepped walk into the law. But you were born and raised outside Dublin in a diverse population. Your father was a builder and then had an accident and he went into teaching the arts that he had practiced. Your mom was the ambitious one, both hardworking. You were very clear about that. But there was a sense of ambition that you had. You could be either a doctor or a lawyer. What was that like, having that sense of circulating around you in the family circle?
Yeah, so like coming through the 80s, the only people that had money from an outsider's perspective were the accountants, the lawyers, and the doctors. Mm-hmm. And so my parents were, certainly my mom, was very driven to push me through any sort of social boundaries to a place where I could occupy those higher reaches of Irish society. And that was how she laid it out. And so from a very young age, I was penciled in and registered to be in a private school, which was fee paying on my parents and expensive. And so she showed that ambition that she had in herself and sort of lived it somewhat through her children. My dad, he did build structures, but his true trade was drywalling, as you call it here, was plastering.
He built a house for you?
He built our home. He built at least two other homes, you could say, outside of his work in a trade school. He became an instructor in a trade school because, as a plasterer, you know, drywalling in North America involves sort of mudding the area between two big sheets of gyprock. In Europe or in Ireland, plastering involves putting that mud entirely across the wall. And so it's a trade in and of itself. Hanging the drywall sheets or gyprock is really just the start of it's basically a blank canvas. and he would do both walls and ceilings in his trade until he did damage his back and spent, you know, a couple of months unable to work. And he had three kids at the time, including myself. And so he decided, listen, I need something more stable. And he had the skills to be able to go into a facility in a tough part of Dublin, in Ireland, actually, which was bringing in these, you know, tougher kids from the streets, basically, to show them how to be tradespersons. And so he got a job with the government.
How'd he do it? I mean, if it was a tough road to hoe in terms of the students he had, did he manage okay with it? I mean, it was something that sometimes people have a certain pride in being able to take kids who are struggling and bring them along.
Yeah, he wasn't a very effusive man about the students in his classes. He did tell a story, I think, that made him quite sad, where there was a time where there was the art of joy riding, which was being engaged with by some of these young guys, where they'd steal a car and potentially write it off or be caught by the police. And he sort of set down a few of these guys and said, listen, you know, you're going to die doing this. You know, this is, you know, do you want to be here on Monday when the class starts? And they said, well, what do we have to live for? And I think that actually really, it really saddened him.
It hit him.
It hit him hard because he didn't tell me many stories like that. So he did take pride in working with some of these guys. I'm sure the class was quite mixed too, but there was definitely some rough diamonds in there for sure. And just added to the ethos of, you know, getting his kids educated and the worthiness of spending a lot of money on private education, which, you know, in the end, when I got to be an apprentice lawyer, the lawyer that hired me passed remarked that I'd gone to the same school him and his kids had gone to. So it definitely did shoot me into the upper echelons, I think, of places where someone like me from a mixed background, working class background, could thrive, that I would end up trying to grow the perfect carrot after all those years of preparation, I'm sure was a little bit of a shock. I evolved to be a little bit more like my dad, I think, in the end.
Yeah. So what was the trajectory from leaving school and then going into law? Did you go right next door, or did you have to look around a bit? How did that go?
No, like before I'd left what you guys would call high school, what we call secondary school in Ireland, by age 16, 17, my direction was pretty set. And there were certain steps to go through and certain grades to be achieved and certain, you know, examinations to excel in. And I worked hard because that's all I knew to do. I knew that hard work it wasn't optional in my home. So off I went and I did my books and I passed my exams and certainly had to repeat one or two along the way right through law school. I got to be a qualified lawyer by age 26. And so earlier you said I practiced law for 12 years. I practiced as a fully qualified lawyer for about 4 years, but it took a good 10 years to get there. And that's par for the course. If you know, I chose to do a degree in law and then a master's in law. And then I had my 4 years as apprenticing, doing my articling, as they call it in the Law Society of Ireland. Yeah. And so, you know, when you add all those years up, it was a very, very long time spent pursuing law, practicing law, learning the law, all of which culminated in me really feeling a little bit lost and unsettled when I finally got there.
And that was something that precipitated this taking advantage of this opportunity to just to bog off and see what's going on in the rest of the world.
Yeah, I mean, like I began to just surrender to, I mean, you call it when we chatted yesterday, serendipity, but the universe, I believe, has a flow to it. And when you're doing what you should be doing, and I'm not saying it's easy, but I'm saying that you flow with it and things feel right and they are right and things come together. It's a bit of a twisted way of saying what's for you won't pass you by. And it never felt for me that I was fully in the place that I needed to be. Once I got to be a practicing lawyer, it wasn't a case of being in the wrong area of law, of which there are many. It felt like I was actually a very long way from where I needed to journey to. Yeah. And actually, you know, I speak it now like it was a sort of a simple enough process for me to sit down and figure that out and accept. It was actually very, very tough for me.
Yeah.
And very bewildering. And I went through some challenging times trying to find it in myself to accept that it just wasn't where I belonged, and I had no idea where I did.
Well, you know, sometimes parents, with the best of intentions, they want their kids to do well, and they feel that it's important that you do well, or you know, your life will fall apart, and don't realize that there's a lot of different ways to have that go well. And sometimes outwardly doesn't look like what they conceived of, but it works for you as their child, and it takes you a while to figure it out. I mean, Heinrich Heine, the poet, the German poet, was supposed to be a doctor or a lawyer, and he wanted to be a poet. It took about 10 years to convince his parents that he was on the right track, and now he's one of the best-known German poets ever. So you did finally set off on your bike. You ran it through marathons, and that was fun, but it wasn't the same as heading out across the waters. So how did that happen? You literally took your bike, got on the ferry, and went straight to France? Or did you go through the colonizing nation across the Irish Sea?
No, I rode my bike literally from a town very close to my hometown. My dad dropped me off, I remember, with my bike and my panniers. You know, my panniers had, you know, a few changes of clothes and a tent and some cooking utensils and some gas and all the things a person uses to camp out.
Mm.
But literally everything I needed to exist was on that bike.
Mm.
And he gave me a hug and he said, good luck. And so I rode down all the way down to the south of Ireland where the ferry leaves. And the really naive and silly thing about this whole story is, of course, I arrived in the north of France at the start of November. And thinking that, you know, how bad can Europe be in November?
And you soon found out.
I soon found out, riding through Cherbourg and along the west coast of France, these amazing weather systems coming in off the Atlantic. Well, a channel.
Welcome to Europe, they said.
Welcome to Europe. Thankfully, there was these amazing set meals. You could sit down in these little dinky restaurants along the road that just kept me alive. I also managed to bump into, believe it or not, another crazy human being who was making almost the exact same trip on a bicycle. And his name, I kid you not, was Jack Cousy. Jacuzzi. And Jacuzzi had been a train conductor in Strasbourg, of all places, and had decided to ride his bike from the north of Scotland to, wait for it, South Africa. And I coincided with his trip through France. And I rode with him for quite a bit of it. I was heading towards Corsica and Sardinia. He was heading due south straight through Spain. And, you know, after we chatted yesterday, I actually, Jacuzzi came back to me and I regret not staying on the road with him and changing my plan. His English was quite poor, unfortunately.
Where was he from originally?
He was from Strasbourg, and he was a good 20 years older than me. I mean, and it was hard to get his backstory because, you know, we're dealing with a fairly large language barrier.
Mm.
But Jacuzzi was heading for South Africa. And, you know, I think me now, age 44, I'd have jumped on the serendipity train and I'd have said, Jack, let's hit the road. At the time, I was a bit more driven towards my own direction. So we parted company in a town called Poitiers in the middle of France.
Mm-hmm.
And off he went. And I'll never know.
You'll never know for sure.
Facebook wasn't a thing at the time, so I didn't get to stay in contact with Jack.
No.
God, if you're out there, Jack, I hope you made it.
Yes, there's a company out there named after you, so don't worry. You've made something. Where did you go? You went to France. You hit the weather. You met Jacuzzi.
I did.
And then what did you do?
I had to take some time out. The weather got so bad. I stayed with some friends in Lille for a little bit of time. Mm. Then resumed my trip. I remember getting to Nice and getting a boat from Nice to the island of Corsica, which is a phenomenal place.
Mm.
People don't really talk about Corsica much as a destination, but it's imagine the Alps stuck in the ocean. And that's what Corsica is. Some odd people up in the mountains for sure. But rode through Corsica and Sardinia, and then a boat from the bottom of Sardinia to Naples, the football team.
Mm.
I made a good decision getting to Naples of buying a Maradona jersey, who had played soccer for Napoli for the peak of his career and is still revered as a godlike character in Napoli. I got so many cheers and celebrations.
You were identified.
I rode that bike down the Amalfi Coast with Maradona on my back.
And crowds chasing you and cheering.
Really, I actually got a lot of love for that.
You ended in Croatia, at Mostar.
Yeah.
Which is a little Islamic enclave surrounded by somewhat hostile Serbs and Croats.
Yeah.
One day, you were in this town and you went into a store and asked if they knew where a place to stay might be.
Yeah.
What happened next?
Yeah, so I'd arrived to Croatia at the end of my trip and decided to take a dink, as they might say in Canada, eastward into Bosnia, which was the epicenter of the fallout of Yugoslavia, and rode up streets where I was told, don't go and camp off of these roads because there's still unexploded ordnance in those bushes. So I quickly began to realize that I was having a very, very, for me, inspiring special experience in this culture that had really come through the most of traumatic of fallouts. And in the middle of all this is a town called Mostar, where a form of Bosnian called a Bosniak of Islamic descent, descended from the Turks actually, lives. And in the fallout of Bosnia, that community, the Bosniak community, had been targeted by both the Croat and the Serb sub-factions of Yugoslavia at separate times. They really got it hard. And I arrived into this town called Mostar, which was a famously embattled town throughout the times, and was low on sugar and low on money. And so I went into a little shop and I met this lovely young lady behind the counter, and I bought a bottle of Coca-Cola from her to fix my sugar levels. And I said, listen, I'm trying to avoid the old tourist trap thing here and save a bit of cash. Do you know anywhere that's decent to stay in and not too expensive? She said, well, why don't you just come and stay with my family for the next couple of nights and you can give us 10 euro a night. And I said, deal. And so myself and this young lady anyway are walking into the Bosniak community of Mostar and walking through literally shelled out ruins of houses to her house, which her dad had rebuilt proudly from literally a situation where they had been trapped in their own basement for months on end as mortars pummeled their hometown. And so I got the privilege of living with this family for a couple of days in Mostar, and they gave me the guest room and really just treated me like a lord, really, to be honest. And I, through our broken command of English, I got to chat with the dad, who proudly showed me his tattoos of Marshal Tito and explained how Tito had unified Yugoslavia and how proud he'd been to fight in his army and how sad he was of how things had, fallen apart there. And me and her mom sat down and we watched the videos of the graduation of her younger sister, and there was lots of giggling and admirations of dresses and stuff like that in this VCR video. And it just was all so lovely and homey. And at the end of it all, they kind of, we parted company. I had to go back to Croatia on my bicycle, and they said, come back, and don't give us any money. Just come back, stay in touch. And so they were just so caring and so relieved to have somebody from, quote unquote, the outside world come into their world and maybe just sort of honor and respect their existence, them being virtually dehumanized for a long time.
The striking thing, and it's coming back to me as we're talking about it, was how open and sort of unguarded they were towards somebody who was clearly, they didn't see you as threatening, they saw you as coming from a faraway place, but instantly sort of on the same path as they were, which is to try and make something out of their lives in some fashion.
Well, Warren, it's incredibly disarming to come across a slightly sunburnt Irish man in Lycra with everything that he has hanging off of his bicycle. I think I definitely had some very easy border crossings with dubious visa entitlements between countries like Serbia and Montenegro. because, you know, these very aggressive and well-armed guards at these border crossings just found me too pathetic to worry about, and just waved me through with a kind of a sad look in their eyes.
Yes, poor and lad, so, where will he end up?
And so what I learned from that bike trip, though, really fully, is people are good, you know, and in this day and age, with a politic that's become so divisive and so angry, we must remember that people are good. And if you put yourself in a position of vulnerability with your average person out there, they will look after you.
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful conclusion to draw from what you went through. And it reminds me of a story of a couple, an elderly couple in Manhattan, who went wandering through the darkest, most theoretically threatening place that you could be, Harlem and white, and they were carrying bags. And the you know, there's black young men standing around outside burning barrels, and, you know, notoriously, theoretically dangerous. They were accosted by some of these young men who said, "Can we help you get to where you're going?"
Yeah.
And they took them onto the subway to their hotel, because they didn't know where they were. They were lost. Took them all the way, carried their bags, and shook hands and said, "No, you don't have to give us any tips or anything like that. We're just happy to help you." Because there was a sort of an innocence, that the innocence factor goes a long way.
Yeah.
You came back to Ireland. You weren't kept forever on the continent. And one of the things you did was go to a Buddhist monastery in the West Coast.
Yeah, a retreat center, and definitely there's a little monastery there, a meditation center. I was drawn to there because, you know, I was curious about the intersection between Catholicism and Buddhism in the area of meditation and mindfulness, and also the setting. It's, if you can imagine, this cluster of, you know, little cottages and this shrine room with big glass windows perched right on a cliff looking out over the wild Atlantic. It's a magical place. If anyone's in Ireland, it's called Zodchan Bera on the Bera Peninsula of Cork. It really is a place to witness. I needed space. I needed to gather my thoughts. I had also come across, you know, a piece of my life in the lead up to this bike journey had been the realization that we were facing the greatest challenge as a species we've ever faced in climate change.
And it wasn't from Al Gore that you found out, it was a potato farmer.
No, that was I had wandered into a farmer's market one Saturday and had always bought vegetables from this one particular sullen, sort of somewhat grumpy farmer who wasn't, you know, a chatter by any ways or means. And I finally sort of decided to try and, you know, start a chat with him. And I said, "How are things on your farm?" And he said, "Well, you know, things are changing on my farm." You know, this is 2006. So we, you know, literacy around the issue of climate change wasn't necessarily very advanced, but certainly not in Ireland. But he said, my grandfather planted seed potatoes the same time every year. And so did my father before him. But I'm finding it tougher to know when to put the seeds in the ground. And what he was describing was a shifting in the seasons driven by climate change in Ireland, which meant that the winter was lasting longer, it was starting later, and it was warm right up to Christmas Day often. But then, and then this sort of a winter phase, which would last longer than it really ought to, and then suddenly switch into a very warm sort of season without that sort of natural message to the grower that has a sort of an attunement with their land, which said, you know, plant your seed potatoes. And so he was just sensing this change with his level of intuition was quite severe.
And you said he'd never used the phrase climate change. You could tell because you were starting to understand a little bit about it.
Exactly. That. Yeah. I had come across the concept, but I hadn't really registered that it was actually changing the weather systems of my life. And so I got a window into reality for the grower of that time, and then it stuck with me. So,
and then something, we'll call this serendipity, or somebody was planning your life for you, and that was that there was a course just about to take off at University of Edinburgh.
Yeah, and so, you know, when I left on my bike trip across Europe, I had thought to myself, well, how can I, as a lawyer, get involved in this issue, you know, and had cast about and couldn't see a clear next step in the world of law, because at that moment in time, a bunch of law professors in Edinburgh University had come together to fashion and create the world's first global climate change law master's degree. And they were, you know, in discussion at that point and were thinking, okay, next September we'll launch this course, or we'll launch it, you know, in time for next September so that people can register for it and so on and so on. My bike ride, as I left Ireland, it didn't exist. And then at the end of my bike trip, I came across it. And then I was in this Buddhist retreat center. In between, I came to my parents' home, where you're only really allowed to sit still for a couple of minutes before you're supposed to start doing something useful.
Get busy.
Exactly, yeah. Get that Lycra off and get behind the computer. And so I had a moment there to send in my application. And then at this Buddhist retreat center with its patchy internet connection, I was trying to, you know, log in and figure out how they got offered the course, what did they need from me. And so I was offered the course and accepted the course there and went straight from there to Edinburgh University.
And worked like a dog for a year.
Yeah, it was a huge step up in academic standards. I mean, I don't know where the university's ranked now, but at the time it was the 20th ranked university on the planet. Yeah. And it really did. It really challenged me. And as I always do, I knuckled down and did the multitude of hours of work, seeing it as a privilege, and came out sort of right in the middle of the class where I always tend to end up.
Good place to be.
It's good
they
enough.
They can't pick you off.
It's good enough. I'm Mr. B grade, but I'll be a B grade at everything, even if I start off bad at it.
When you're 90.
Mr. All-rounder.
It was hard work. Did it light a fire, or did it keep the fire burning that was starting to burn in you? Did it give you a sense that you had some real tools?
Yeah, I think it gave me a great sense of the international infrastructure that exists around this big, unwieldy topic that, you know, we all struggle to wrap our heads around and confront or manage. And it gave me a sense of how institutions develop around our problems as a species, and how those institutions can be somewhat of a hindrance to getting the thing resolved. An advanced legal system should be very, you know, very a small step behind where the conversation is and tracking where the problem's at. A poor legal system creates a whole bunch of processes and theories that in the end mean that the law is way behind where it should be.
They're obstructions more than they are facilitating.
They can be. Yeah. I think so. And I mean, I'm not here to dagger all lawyers on the planet. They tend to form institutions that unfortunately serve their professions more than society.
I think society as a whole constructs these institutions, like the corporation, the way it's structured to serve only its shareholders. Yeah. I mean, it's a great idea in the 1700s and 1800s, but it's completely outdated today. And yet it's just a legal structure. That's all it is.
Yeah. And then the law tries to catch up with that problem and creates a legal concept called corporate social responsibility and tries to create some structure around that. Yeah. And it, of course, isn't functional enough to prevent what really is the issue with corporations, which is undue pressure and monopolization and influence over our politicians. Mm-hmm. A corporation can be completely benign, or it can get to a size where it becomes a parasite on society.
Absolutely. And often depends on the person who's at the top. The person at the top could be enlightened or a fool.
Absolutely.
And that goes crazy or well. Now, I was interested to learn from you that there were only a couple of places in the world where you really felt you could go and fit into an existing or pre-existing kind of legal format. One was Geneva in Switzerland, of course. That's not that surprising. There's lots of international institutions in that particular part of the world. But the other place was Vancouver in British Columbia, Eco-Justice and West Coast Environmental Law, which, of course, I'm very familiar with and most British Columbians have heard something about. But it was a place that was, from your learning, was somewhat unique. Geneva or Vancouver?
Absolutely. Maybe it's not something we realize here in British Columbia, but those two law firms are very globally unique and staffed with you know, because I was lucky enough to spend time as a legal assistant to EcoJustice, staffed with some very, very, very smart people.
Yeah.
Very, very talented people.
Now, this is 2011 when you came across the water and flew, you know, paddled across the Atlantic.
I actually took a train from Halifax to Vancouver as well, because of my climate fears.
And what was that like? Did you say, oh my God, this is a lot bigger than Ireland?
Oh, it's magical. It's a must-do. Please put that on every Canadian's bucket list. When you know, they have these rail cars, you can sit on this sort of a glass dome.
Yes, indeed.
And I can remember traveling across the prairies and seeing the Rockies for the first time in my life, you know, across the dead flatness. And what a magical experience. The Rockies rising up from the prairies is a sight that everyone should see sometime in their life.
You know, it's funny because the famous English poet Rupert Brooke, and he came to Canada and he hung around and he ended up in the Rockies. And he went home because he said, I'm scared, they're too big.
Yeah.
It was just so different from what he was used to. Your budding movie career took off temporarily while you were working as a Wilderness Committee climate campaigner. The name of the film was To the Ends of the Earth. Now, it wasn't, but it was an interesting film. I've seen it a couple of times, and I know you were co-starring with Jodie Wilson-Raybould.
Okay.
You know, and you were co-starring with Chief Roland Wilson of the West Moberly First Nation, who is very much a public figure in this half of the country.
Yeah.
And, of course, the farmers, Ken and Arlene Boone. There's a scene with you walking through, with Ken walking through the field and talking to him about the sad story. Just 3 months ago, the flooding took place of the lower part of his property.
Yeah.
What was that like being, I mean, you were right there. So what was it like walking through the fields with Ken Boone? I've met him, talked to him a few times. It was pretty sad.
Yeah, and to end up at that stage, so I had made the switch out of trying to pursue answers to climate change through the medium of law. I had stepped out into sort of public advocacy for the Wilderness Committee as their climate campaigner. And through our work in the sort of Fort St. John area around the connection between the fracking up there for gas and the Site C proposed at the time, Site C Dam, and the loss of some pristine, very precious farmland in that valley to the dam. I was very blessed to meet Ken, and I was left with the strongest sense of his connection to that soil and his awareness of how valuable it was. Because in that part of the world, you don't get that grade of soil everywhere.
No.
And
the Peace River Valley is also a unique ecosystem because it's sheltered by the quite steep banks of the valley.
Exactly.
And the climate within the riparian zone is really quite unusual.
And so the key point at the time that had brought me to Ken and had brought the Wilderness Committee to the Site C proposal, despite it being, you know, quote unquote clean energy, was the pointier question of whether or not we needed the power. And at the time, my life took a great divergence soon after this, so I never stayed in contact with the issue of whether it was ever proven by the BC Utilities Commission and so on that we actually, as British Columbian taxpayers, needed to fund the creation of that project.
The evidence actually is quite clear that it wasn't necessary. There's some studies that have been submitted to the BCUC, the BC Utilities Commission, showing that if the amount of money was being spent on the dam was converted into run-of-river projects and similar kinds of renewable energy and less invasive projects, they could generate just as much electricity without flooding a whole bunch of high-quality farmland and without reducing water flow into Lake Athabasca, which is now really threatened with low water intrusions because of these cutoffs. It was.
And so that was the main thing. I mean, a farmer like Ken could accept the loss that he knew he would eventually suffer if we as a society needed that, if it was warranted by some special need we had. The needlessness of it all was what rang home for me.
Yeah, and I think that makes sense. Now, there still is a slap suit, strategic legal action to prevent.
It stands for something.
Against the Boone family and indigenous
public participation.
Yeah, public participation
stands for P. Yeah. Public participation.
And it's BC Hydro that's been suing them because they set up some camps in the woods that obstructed some of the activities to do with the Site C dam.
Yeah.
Did that come up as a topic? But just maybe you could just outline the basic principle behind slap suits so that listeners can understand this kind of ridiculous approach.
I mean, it varies in different parts of the world, and there are measures, anti-slap laws, that are designed to try and prevent what basically is a corporation bringing or an entity bringing a legal case against you that they know is unfounded for the sheer purpose of shutting you up.
Yeah.
And that's a very, very crude or lay person's way of putting that. I, as I said, soon after I was featured in that documentary or show, To the Ends of the Earth, my life took a, I was coming to the end of my time as a climate campaigner, an energy, you know, advocate, and was soon to move on to my life here in the shoe shop as a farmer. So I was on, I'm not aware of how the slap suits played out for those guys. It doesn't
still ongoing.
Me.
Still ongoing.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me. Yeah. And I think once John Horgan, RIP, decided to pursue the project, I think, you know, we all knew that there wasn't much purpose to fighting on.
Yeah.
It was a done deal.
So you diverged in a very significant way.
So I found myself in need of accommodations in Vancouver, and had been introduced to a young lady called Emily, who was interested in the area, the intersection between trade union activism and environmentalism. And she at the time worked for an entity called Green Jobs BC, which may or may not still be around. And she also worked for an entity called the Edible Garden Project, which is definitely still around. And what they did was they farmed the bare patches of land in the city, urban farming at its best.
Indeed.
And so I was lucky enough to be introduced to Emily, and we got on pretty well. And then she let me know that there was a spare room for rent in this house of four bedrooms that she was renting in as well. And so I got to meet the other flatmates and became a flatmate of Emily, and then eventually became Emily's husband. We ended up getting an apartment in North Vancouver and living together as continuing as flatmates. And then I proposed to her eventually, and she hatched a plan to farm in the shoe shop.
Well, it's a mixture of practicality and romance, which is it's a heady mixture.
Dirty romance, you might say.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
Muddy romance. That's a bit better.
So 2016, you took the plunge, you headed north.
Yes.
What happened? Where'd you go?
So in the Edible Garden Project world, there were people who also wanted to pursue this dream of just getting out on the land and farming, not necessarily in a very sort of back to the land kind of way, more in a practical, let's show that we can actually make a business of this and actually be a viable farming business.
And there's an important difference today in the movement back to the land. In the 60s with the hippies, it was people who had a vision but not much practical experience, and they weren't seeing themselves as part of across the board movement. It was more a rebellion against sort of establishment values. But people like you and Emily are doing it because there's a future that's beckoning us. And if we don't accord ourselves with the principles we need to live this future in, we're going to be in serious trouble. There's a kind of a motivation that's more grounded and more serious.
Absolutely. Yeah. I guess I'm just on the outside of that group of people called the millennials. And I think we tend to be a bit more of a practical bunch with a point to prove maybe in our work. Mm. And I don't want to do what I do unless it provides a viable income for me and my family.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the point that I want, and we are wanting to prove through our farm and also the farms that we support as Nature Delivered, is to say that this is a viable career.
It started out as a farm, Enderberry Farm, that was the original part.
Yeah.
And then Shoe Swap Organics.
Mm-hmm.
What was that modulation about?
Yeah, well, so we started out co-owning a farm called Enderberry Farm, and then we outgrew that relationship and and acquired our own land in Grinrod, where we farm to this day. Shoe Shop Organics, we created that because, well, we found ourselves in this odd Bermuda Triangle in the sort of Enderby Grinrod area, where we were considered too far away from the farmers markets in Kelowna, and likewise the ones in Kamloops, and likewise the major ones in Revelstoke. And so we were, like I call it, that we found ourselves in the odd Bermuda Triangle, where we were forced to find a way to, you know, produce food and sell food that wasn't farmers market based. And so, you know, we decided to start offering that food to restaurants and stores. We were also actually producing a type of jam and chutney, which is now called tomato chutney. Also, we had chosen the name Shoe Shop Organics for that. And when I was going into these stores trying to sell this chutney, I had these stores saying, you have a farm? Yeah, I said, well, you know, what about your vegetables? And so we kind of fell into this situation where we were supplying stores and restaurants. And the name Shoe Shop Organics we'd chosen for our chutney actually was a great name also for our line of vegetables that we were able to grow. And so we just, you know, the brand just sort of developed from there. And then slowly but surely, it really came apparent during COVID that although produce prices and food prices in general, but specifically produce prices, were rising exponentially, doubling in some cases, the value that farmers like us were receiving for that, and this isn't across the board, but in many cases we were not receiving the increase in prices that the stores were charging on to customers like you and me. And so we quickly realized that we wanted to be the store. We wanted to be how we could reach customers like you and Tom directly. And so also during COVID, the art of actually the food coming to you through door-to-door delivery had developed and had shown signs that it could survive in the marketplace as a standalone system.
And it's a relatively small size food web, if you want to call it. It's not 5,000 kilometers. It's 30 kilometers or 50 kilometers.
Yeah, we support 8 or 9 farms that are all in the Enderby, Grinrod, Mara area. With fruit, there's definitely better fruit grown in the Vernon, Kelowna area. And so we do draw some fruit from farms in the sort of Lake Country. But that's as far as away as we need to go to find good, high quality local food grown by farming families that just want to make a living and do what they love to do. And so by getting direct to people's doors as nature delivered, we found that we were able to compete with the inflated prices that, unfortunately, all the major brands, including your Walmarts and your Costcos, are adopting right now. We have found that by skipping those and going straight to the customer and to their, literally to their door, we can offer a higher quality product that supports local growers at a comparable price.
Yeah, which is an evolving process as the large scale producers, well, distributors of food, the big chains, are doing what one might judiciously call the wrong thing. In other words, taking out more profit from a system that's allows you to do that. You're competing with them on a basis of a certain amount of integrity. The food quality is good. You're not having to charge exorbitant sums to get it to people. And yet it's, you know, a lot of people are starting to say, I'd like to know where my food's coming from.
Yeah.
And like to know the person who's growing it and maybe the person who's delivering it. In other words, have sort of a personal connection. That's part of a revolution that's taking place.
Yeah. And if you want to spread the nature of that revolution wider, I didn't know this, but I'm starting to believe that actually food is the medium to which we can get to people, period. You know, as we get drawn into this horrible, divisive, aggressive politic, I think that food is a grounding norm we all got to eat. And so without getting too woo-woo shishi on this, I believe us bringing really good quality food to the people matters and makes a bit of a change to them in their lives. And of course, we can see the effect it has on the farming families, including our own, that get to be part of this because it provides a security in a stable state. It's a win-win situation. The big wide web of the food system that draws food from Mexico and California and, God forbid, apples from New Zealand or whatever, yes, is itself struggling through the increased cost of gasoline, I think through the impact of climate change and droughts. You know, we've had the highway shutdowns in 2021, I want to say.
Yeah, that was 21, yeah, the floods, roads being
the
washed
Coca-Cola.
Out.
Yeah, we were the only supplier to some major stores in the region. We sold months worth of food in 4 days because nobody could get product from anyone but us.
Did you sense people waking up when you were delivering those food items to them? They were sort of saying, you know, I thought we'd be stuck, but you guys are here and this is a really good way to do it.
It's amazing how resilient the status quo is to glaring insights into how messed up it is and how quickly society can just resume how it always functioned. I think it left a mark. I think there are more impacts to come from climate change on our food system. I don't want to sound like an opportunist, but I think that works in our favor.
Mm. Well, I think it does.
Well, and there's a broader move, no matter, you know, even if you take some of the sentiment behind what's happening in the United States right now, what you can identify across all different factions is a move towards localization, mm-hmm, and a rejection and an anger towards globalization.
You use the phrase being in opposition to disaster capitalism. And I think that's a very apt phrase, because Naomi Klein's book about big corporations taking advantage of the fact that if something went awry, they'd step in and expand their markets. But there's no reason why a small operation, a local operation, an operation embedded in community connections can't do the same thing when the disaster is really undercutting these large corporations' supply lines and their delivery routes and their you know, cheap labor grown food far away.
Yeah, I mean, it came up in our conversation because I think what has happened, our food bill, like how much it costs us to just go and get our food for our families, the reflection of how increased that price is actually a sign of a form of disaster capitalism, where I believe that some of the few, you know, businesses that have monopolized food in Canada took advantage of the situation. Mm-hmm. I do. I believe that.
Profits are up for large distributors, very much so. That's been well documented. Now, we're getting towards the end of the show, and I want to bring up something that's also been part of your life, and that is your involvement with the Green Party and with actual formal political activities. And I want to read a little quote from Jane Philpott. She's written a book called Health for All. And she describes how it felt for her as a politician to be able, with the stroke of a pen, to change the lives of hundreds of thousands of people for the better. And I wonder if, would you compare and contrast your own situation and why you think a political path is one to pursue? I mean, she's laid out a path that anybody could follow. How does that resonate with you?
Yeah, it's a bit like that drive to get on my bicycle and wildly cycle into Europe in November of all months. It's just a draw I have naturally, and I've had it for decades. I think my draw to it is ever increasing become the protection of democracy itself and the frustration that I feel around how archaic the political system is in this country. I grew up in a country with proportional representation. I now have adopted a new country that has the first past the post system. And I'm living through the disaster of how inept that system is for all of us and how short it sells every Canadian citizen. So my drive has shifted to want to participate in democracy, to stand up and be a voice within democracy, and to fight for a change in how we elect our governments, period. Mm. The Green Party has always been incredibly clear and ambitious and has fought for proportional representation from the beginning. The other large political parties are too happy to bounce power over and back between them to want to change it, despite our current prime minister once promising to change it once he was elected.
You know, it's interesting that the countries that have first past the post are all ex-colonies of Britain.
Yeah.
And Ireland broke free in that sense and developed a political system, proportional political system or electoral system, that really illustrates coming out from under the firm planted foot of the British government.
Yeah, I don't want to describe the Irish as political scientists. I think being part of the European Union was there are many things in Ireland that are only there because it was part of the European Union. And I think the German people and their society is, for me, the most underestimated and underappreciated society on earth.
Mm.
And so Europe has the Germans to thank for an awful lot of the intelligence that's there in its systems. And proportional representation would have come from that, you know, realization that there are better systems out there. And we just need to look abroad in Canada and stop selling ourselves short. Really, it is a backward system we have here.
In Germany, the proportional approach was introduced so that somebody like Hitler could never come back and take over.
Yeah.
Now I want to close with talking about something that's quite well established, and that is that parents with young children, you have a 3.5-year-old daughter, end up being the most passionate advocates of change, especially change that's equitable, that introduces an awareness of our life on the planet and how we have to cherish this home that we have.
Mm-hmm.
How has having a young daughter increased your level of motivation?
Yeah, you know, it's strange. When I it took a lot of debate between me and my wife to open up. You know, we knew what state the world was in environmentally and ecologically and politically. And the concept of bringing new life into that world was something we were challenged by.
Mm.
But we figured, you know, if we're not going to procreate, then we really are done. And so, you know, you can have a child as a slight act of revolution too. And so, but the shocking thing about my daughter is not that I feel sorry for her or that I have any doubts about bringing her into this world or being part of that, but how reassuring she has been for me. There's something about these kids that are coming into the world right now, and they ain't taking no prisoners.
Yeah.
She is a powerful, powerful human being and is in control a lot of the time. Without us being neglectful parents, there's definitely a sense of a powerhouse human having arrived. And so for me, as we head into a politic that's definitely becoming a little bit more masculine and more aggressive, we'll say, in nature, I believe there's a sleeping giant amongst the more female end of our society. And I hope that she doesn't change.
The statistics are in favor of your opinion on that subject. There's a lot of evidence that women are leading a lot of the transformational changes taking place.
Yeah.
And a lot of people involved with it who recognize that fact. I think your daughter has a couple of friends, adult friends, you and Emily, who are going to make sure that as she progresses through her life, she has a bit of a head start, not just to be an ambitious performer in the world, but to make the world a better place. It's been a real treat to have you with us today, Owen. Thank you very much for joining us in this studio today.
My pleasure. Thank you.